TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Pathology of Wealth. The first talk of 2012 by the social critic and noted author Michael Parenti fit perfectly into the debates of the time, that of the 1 versus the 99%, and the finally no longer taboo question, what exactly is capitalism? Michael Parenti spoke on January 6 at the La Peña Cultural Center in Berkeley, California. He is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts. Raised in a working-class district of New York City, Parenti went on to earn a PhD in political science from Yale. He lost his chance at an academic career when he openly opposed the war on Vietnam. Here's Michael Parenti.
Okay. Thank you very much. I actually want to talk about something I call the pathology of wealth, or profit pathology. I've given it two names, because that's the thing that's really oppressing us and much of the world today. And capitalist ideology, and it does have an ideology, has numerous popular myths attached to it, what the anthropologists would call the Miranda and the Sacranda, you know, the scenarios that to be admired and the ones that are sacred, the stories that are sacred about its origin and its meaning. And the myth of capitalism has a lot of that. There's the myth of capitalism and social prosperity, that capitalism just brings social prosperity. Well, in fact, most of the world is capitalist and most of the world is poor. Don't talk about social prosperity to capitalist Nigeria. Don't talk about it to capitalist Honduras or capitalist Indonesia or any number of places. There's the other myth about capitalism and individual success and ready access to wealth for those who have the gumption and the get-go. Capitalism and the free market self-regulation, you know, I'll be talking much more about that later on. Capitalism brings international trade and peace. You notice all the peace we've got in capitalism? I think I slept late one weekend and I missed the peace. And capitalism and its supposed symbiosis with democracy. And that's another thing I was going to talk about tonight. You know, I've written about that one so long, I just thought I would just meander around on some of these other subjects. There's one common theme or myth when you launch into a critique of capitalism. It's the one I call the mom and pop litany. It's the people who then celebrate the entrepreneurial spirit and say, well, two people start a little business and then it grows and they employ some other people. And it's usually said in this sentimental, nostalgic, sing-song way and all that. And I think those are good, actually. I've been accused on the internet, you know, you get accused of everything on the internet. Some guy wrote, Parenti is soft on small business. In fact, I am. I think small businesses are okay, you know. But we're not talking about small businesses tonight. We're talking about giant corporations. As Lenin said about 100 years ago, you didn't know I was going to quote Lenin so early in the talk. He was in one of his more hyperbolic moments, too. He said, a million small businesses count for nothing. A few giant cartels count for everything. They are what lay down the law. They are the thing that shaped the face of the whole society and such. So whenever I talk about capitalism, I'm not talking about mom and pop, but I'm talking about the big corporations, okay? The free market core mythology, to which both political parties in this country and just about all mainstream commentators are wedded to, argues in effect that, and here I'm kind of paraphrasing John Maynard Keynes, because he said this too about free market capitalism. The free market mythology, it argues that the most ruthless, selfish, opportunistic, greedy, calculating plunderers, applying the most heartless measures in cold-blooded pursuit of corporate interests and wealth accumulation, will produce the best results for all of us through something called the invisible hand. And Keynes, really, he mocked that too. He didn't have as many adjectives as I did, but he said, how do they think that the most wicked, I that was the word he used, the most wickedest people pursuing the most wickedest ends for the most wickedest means are going to produce these beautiful, what an interesting theory. Where the hell could they ever have gotten it? Marx had three words to sum up the entire process of corporate capitalism. It was accumulate, accumulate, accumulate. And I like that quote because he's recognizing, he doesn't really go into it, he avoids a psychology, and I usually do also, but I think it's time we have to treat some of these guys, put them on the couch or something, since we can't put them on the guillotine. No, I didn't say that. He's giving this compulsive idea, accumulate, and what do you do after that? You accumulate. That's all they do, and that's all they need to do. Mindless, driven. It's a rational pathology. Are you still with me? Okay. The crimes and crises of corporate America are not, in my view, an irrational departure from a rational system. I don't think Bernie Madoff is an aberration. Quite the opposite. I think it's the converse. They are the rational outcomes of a basically irrational and amoral system. The multi-billion dollar government bailouts are themselves turned into an opportunity for pillage. In other words, even when they've been stealing and they're getting money to compensate, they'll steal that money too. They'll steal from the contribution cup out there. Watch your property here. Not only does the state fail to regulate, it becomes itself a source of plunder, pulling vast sums from the federal money machine. We're exploited not only as workers, but as taxpayers and consumers. So if you work at, say, at a nonprofit and all that, that doesn't mean you're not exploited in this society. You're exploited as a citizen of the community. You're exploited especially as a taxpayer. Who was it? Bacon. Which one? This is when you get old. You shouldn't stray from your notes. But some noted commentator, who prefers not to be mentioned right now, the public treasury is about the best investment that capitalists can make. You know, I mean, they'll spend a few million dollars on lobbying and some campaign contributions, and then they'll get a contract for an oil reserve that's worth $20 billion. I mean, there's no investment you can make in the private business world of a few million and come out with $20 billion. I mean, and you can go on plundering and ripping off from the public treasure. It's about the best investment you can make is to buy politicians and then to buy the resources that belong to the people and walk off with it. These reactionaries who scold us for running to the government for a handout themselves run to the government for handouts. Why else would they have thousands of lobbyists? How many lobbyists do you have in Washington? Trying to scratch up some money for you. How many lobbyists you have? I don't see any hands going up hardly. Corporate America yearly enjoys billions of dollars in subsidies, grants and aid, airwave licenses, loan guarantees, bailouts, tax breaks. You can go on, export subsidies. With all the profits it pulls in every year, corporate America is on welfare, and we got to get them off welfare. The essence of free market corporate capitalism is the transformation of living nature into commodities and commodities into dead capital. All money and all treasury notes, all bonds, all stock, they're really sort of kind of promissory notes that there's a real world out there and value is going to keep getting created This stuff, I can cash it. I got these billions of dollars, you see. When left entirely on its own devices, capitalism foists its diseconomies and its toxicity upon the general public and upon the natural environment. And then it does an interesting thing. It eventually begins to devour itself. If the paladins of corporate America want to know what really threatens our way of life, it's their way of life. Their boundless way of pilfering the very community and environment that sustains them. And the more successful they are, the more deadly they become. Like any parasite, if it becomes too successful in its host, it does what? It kills the host, and it's going to be a catastrophe for the host, that's us, and for the parasite too. There's a myth that prosperity is shared by us all. More for them means more for me. I've heard that. I've interviewed people say, well, you know, the big company, they create the jobs that I, you know, and then there's something for me. We hear that a rising tide lifts all boats. You've heard that one, right? I always say a rising tide can sink a lot of ships and drown a lot of people. Still greater wealth for the very few, it means less and less for the rest of us. Now, what's been marvelous with the Occupy movement is that this has been part of the protest. This has actually been recognized, that they actually come out and they start talking about the 1% and the 99%. I think that's a beautiful division. It's much better than those stupid quintile studies used to get. The top 20% make 4 times more or 8 times more than the bottom. What does that mean? What the hell are you talking about? That's not wealth. You know who's in the top 20%? If you make $80,000, you're in the top 20%. You're rich. They say the wealthiest top 20%, the wealthiest quintile, the wealthiest one-fifth make this. No, you got to look at the very, very, very tiny. That one. It's really not even 1%. It's really a fraction of 1%. 1% is, you're talking about 3.5 million people. It isn't that many in the super rich. It's more like 1/10 of 1%. But let's say 1%. We'll give, I mean, because everybody in 1% is doing pretty well. To finally get, you know, these people out there in a mass popular movement talking about the great class divide that some of us have been talking about for 40 years and been trying to get people to recognize, and finding that we're called extreme, we're called ideological, our colleagues in academia would frown at us or smirk and snicker and say, oh, that's a Marxist view or this or that. To finally see people out in the street just coming right out and saying 1% and 99% and seeing it getting picked up by commentators, let me say that's a big ideological victory right there, a victory in words. Now, at this recession that the 1% is presiding over is not such a bad deal for the 1%. They don't mind recessions. Capitalism has never minded recessions. Labor unions are tamed and even broken during recessions. Labor unions have to make concessions. Labor unions have to often go without contracts and such. Smaller business competitors are driven out or bought up for a tuppence, you know. Marx said something about that. One capitalist will destroy many capitalists. You just eat them up. Solidify your market, your field, and take over. Not just labor unions are tamed and broken, but people are tamed and broken. People suddenly get worried. They line up for jobs they never thought they'd have to work for at wages they didn't know they were going to have to work for, work harder and harder for less, and feel grateful that they got something going. And meanwhile, the profits stay pretty high. So I'll tell you what's bad for capitalism, and that's capitalism. It's always in a crisis. It's bad for us, but eventually it'll be bad for the capitalists. They have many opportunistic ways of taking advantage of all this. I'm just telling you right now with the recessions. But eventually there's a limit to that kind of thing. Recession has another useful feature. The plutocracy would prefer a population that is hungry and impoverished and will settle for less and less, that must work harder for less. The plutocracy doesn't mind unemployment. They could live with it, you know. The job providers, Bank of America, I was standing with my neighbor in a cafe. We were waiting in line. And I said, so how's your friends, the corporations? He said, hey, listen, Mike, the corporations are job providers. Isn't that the term they're using? And this was like, I said, wait a minute. You know, yesterday I just heard on the radio yesterday, Bank of America laying off 30,000 people. That's not the way a job provider should act, you know. And one of the things they don't want is they don't want the 99% to be educated, critically aware of their own interests, politically literate, have a strong sense of their own entitlement. That isn't the kind of population they want to deal with. Able to organize and articulate the issues, that isn't what they want. They want us demoralized, they want us demobilized, and they want us disinformed. This also better enables them to pursue global accumulation, such as imperialism and such. Recession is no problem to imperialism. The empire is flourishing. I see people and some authors, a whole bunch of books are being, I wrote the book called The Face of Imperialism there, which takes to task these people who argue that it's all just for glory or it's all just for power. There are very real material interests involved in owning the whole world, you know, and controlling it. And it's not just because we're overweening or we're inept or we're compulsive or we have a messianic save the world complex or something. No. We don't. You might have that, but these guys running the thing are much smarter than you, and they know what they're doing. The empire is stronger than ever. Obama is an imperialist. He is committed now to aerial warfare and attacks on other countries. I pity what is going to happen to Iran. There are commentators who've got it very mixed up, a few on RT that I saw not long ago. Oh, they'll never go into Iran. It's twice the size of Iraq. It's mountainous. It's got twice the population. They would need 1 million troops. They're not going to go in. The Air Force is already, they're going to do what they did to Yugoslavia. They're going to, to Libya for the most part. They're going to destroy it from the air, hit every utility, hit every power station, hit every port, hit every transport center, and kill a lot of other people too. The U.S. Air Force has already announced that they have 10,000 targets in Iran. Former Joint Chief of Staff, he was on the Joint Chief, he just had started on there, Admiral Tommy Mullen, who got up and said, why are we bombing Iran? The Navy's against it and the Army's against it. It's the Air Force that's going to be their show, you see. So we're going to bomb Iran. There's 80 million people, all of them different, all of them human beings. What do we got to do bombing them? He was head of the Joint Chief of Staff. They gave him a gold watch and they retired him. But that's where it's going. We have aerial warfare. We've got larger military budget than ever. With Obama, larger. He keeps increasing it every year. And that's not because he's spineless. It's not because he's a weak sissy. It's because that's what he wants to do. That's what he's been pursuing. New military bases, major bases in Kosovo and Central Asia and other places. Iraq, they call the Green Zone, bigger than Vatican City it is, with its own water resources and energy resources. And the like. This empire feeds off the republic. And the economy suffers. Military spending is capital intensive. It's heavily subsidized. It creates per dollar many less jobs than transportation or teaching or health care or any number of other things that we might want, construction work and the like. The plutocracy also does not want a social democracy with a viable public sector, not only because of what I said before, they don't want people who are organized, alert, and feeling entitled, self-entitled, and so forth, but a not-for-profit sector is a threat to capitalism. They have subsidized housing. They have some other things. They are able to negotiate. Labor is able to, often to fight back, you see, and this is something this was something that bothered Ronald Reagan when he was doing cutbacks. He says, the problem is wages are still up, that wages are not down enough. We got to get them down. A public sector with a social wage demonstrates the viability of public nonprofit services. You get them cheaper and you get them better. It deprives capital of accumulation opportunities. It provides market earnings to public budgets. That's a good one that we should all know about. Take utilities, for instance. We have PG&E here. It's a privately owned utility. We pay the highest rates in the United States. They make enormous profits, PG&E. Now, there are a lot of communities where the utilities, the gas and electric, is publicly owned by the municipality or the state. And your rates are lower because you don't have to spend all that other money on advertising, on profits for the shareholders. And the earnings you make in the public utility goes into the public budget. It goes into the budget and it's used, which means it's easier on your taxes too. But that's just what the plutocrats don't like about that sort of thing, you see. You're demonstrating that you can have production, you can have use, you can have human needs dealt with, you can have money put into the tax ledgers, you can have private consumption and all that, and nobody in your little plutocratic gang is making a profit on it. And it's all cheaper and it's better, lower costs and such. Someday we're going to see public ownership of our utilities here, let us hope. The function of the capitalist state is, of course, to make society, make the economy, make the polity safe for this whole accumulation process, to keep people in line, to circumscribe and diminish the demands of the working populace. But there's another function of the capitalist state, I argue. It's seldom mentioned. It consists of preventing the capitalist system from devouring itself, to protect capitalism from the capitalists, to restrain the self-devouring beast, because that's what it is. It eats everything in sight, including its own feet and its own tail and then its own body, you see. An economy dedicated to speed-ups and wage cuts, to making workers produce more and more for less and less, is always in danger of a crash. To maximize profits, wages must be kept down. But someone has to buy the goods and services being produced. For that, wages must be kept up, or you got to be paying out some wages. There's a chronic tendency, as we're seeing today, toward overproduction of private sector goods and services and underconsumption of necessities by the working populace. So what happens in a situation like this is that recessions, destabilizations, imbalances in it, are the chronic condition. It's not a crisis. That's the natural condition of capitalism. Crises is the normal condition. Hardly 3 years after the Constitutional Convention ended in September of 1797 in Philadelphia came the recession of 1790. The country under the new constitution wasn't even 3 years old, okay? And they had a recession. There was the panic of 1797. There was the recession of 1802 that went on to 1804. There was the depression of 1807 to 1810. There was about 20 more of these crises, panics, recessions in the 19th century. Most notably, the Long Depression of 1873 that went on to 1879, almost to 1880. 1890, four recessions in the 1890s, 1890, 93, 96. 1899, the big one. You know, that was a very troublesome. And what did we need? I tell you what we need. Our buddy, our boy, Teddy Roosevelt told us. He said, this nation needs a war, any war. Yeah, pick it up out of this, you see. Get it going. And that's exactly what they did. They picked a fight with Spain, which was weak and had all these nice, ripe, low-hanging colonies, which the U.S. just ripped off and took. Go into the 20th century, three recessions in the 1920s. I didn't know about that. All I heard about the 1920s, it was the jazz age, Charleston. Remember that? And everybody was having fun. Then came the Great Crash, 1929, a Great Depression, 29 to 41, pulled out of it by a thing called World War II, and so forth. Then 49, 53, 58, and you go on a number of others. There was the one in Reagan's first term, remember? That was a serious one. So in other words, that's the normal condition of an unregulated capitalism. Crises, and we feel it. We're the ones who get the blows, who have to suffer the blows. And also, even at the individual level, living in this kind of society, no Americans, except for the super rich 1%, no Americans have complete economic security. The rest of us are never really secure. Investments can go wrong, job loss, illnesses, your 401k becomes a 101k. All sorts of things like that happen. Under capitalism, we live in our personal recessions, our personal panics and crises. One of two Americans now are below or barely above the poverty level. You know, the fact that you are you know, $500 above the poverty level doesn't mean you're okay. I mean, it's terrible.
That was the first half of a one-hour talk on the pathology of wealth by the internationally known author and lecturer, Michael Parenti. He was recorded in January 2012 in Berkeley, California, by filmmaker John Paroulis. Parenti is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts. His informative and entertaining books and talks have reached a wide range of audiences in North America and abroad. He's the author of over 20 books, among them Democracy for the Few, History as Mystery, and most recently, The Face of Imperialism. His website is michaelparenti.org. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. You can get information on how to order an audio CD of Michael Parenti's talk, The Pathology of Wealth, by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call. Thank you.